Chapter 1 of Murder at Bridge. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Gesine. Murder at Bridge by Anne Austin. Chapter 1. Bonnie Dundee stretched out a long and rather fine pair of legs, regarding the pattern of his dark blue socks with distinct satisfaction. Then he rested his black head against the rich upholstery of an armchair not at all intended for his use. His cheerful blue eyes turned at last, but not too long a last, to the small upright figure seated at a typewriter desk in the corner of the office. "Good morning, Penny," he called out lazily, and good-humouredly waited for the storm to break. "Miss Crane, to you?" The flying fingers did not stop an instant, but Dundee noticed with glee that the slim back stiffened even more rigidly, and that there was a decided toss of the brown bobbed head. "But Penny is so much more like you," Dundee protested, unruffled. "And why should I be forced always to think of you as a long-legged bird, when even our mutual boss, District Attorney William S. Sanderson, has the privilege of calling you what you are, a bright and shining new Penny?" "I've known Bill Sanderson since I was born," the unseen lips informed him truculently, even as the unseen fingers continued their fiercely staccato typing. "Ah, that explains a lot," Dundee conceded handsomely. "I just wondered, amidst all his bonhomie of Bill and Penny, why I only call Mr. Sanderson Bill when I forget," the small creature defended herself sharply. "Goodness knows I tried to be an efficient private secretary, and I could be a lot more efficient if lazy strangers didn't plump themselves down in our best visitor's chair and try to flirt with me. I don't flirt, do you hear? I don't flirt with anybody." "Flirt with you, you funny little Penny?" Dundee's voice was a little sad, the voice of a man who finds himself grievously misunderstood. "I only want you to like me, if you can, and be a little nice to me, for after all I've—" "Oh, I know!" Penny Crane jerked the finished letter from her typewriter and spun about on her narrow-backed swivel chair to face him. "I know you are Mr. James F. Dundee, Special Investigator, attached to the office of the District Attorney, and that you have a right to drive me crazy if you want to." "Crazy?" Dundee was genuinely amazed, contrite. "I beg your pardon most humbly, Miss Crane. I'll go back to my cell. Your office is almost as big and nice as this one," Penny retorted, but her sharp, bright brown eyes, really almost the colour of a new penny, softened until they took on a velvety depth. Dundee did not fail to notice the softening, nor did the little heart-shaped face, with its low widow's peak, its straight, short nose, and its pointed little chin, made almost childish by the deep cleft which cut through its obvious effort to look mature and determined, fail to please him any more acutely than on the other days of the one short week he had been privileged at intervals to gaze upon it. "But the files, and other things, are in this office," he told her, his blue eyes twinkling happily once more. "Don't you dare touch my files again!" Penny cried, springing to her feet and running toward the wall, which was completely concealed by drawers, cabinets, and shelves, filled with the records of which she was the proud custodian. "That's why I said just now that you were driving me crazy. Thursday you took a whole folder of correspondence out of the letter files and put it back under the wrong initial. I had to hunt for it for 2 hours, with Mr. Sanderson, gnawing his nails with impatience. He thought I had filed it wrong, and you might have made me lose my job." Unconsciously her slightly husky contralto voice had sunk lower and trembled audibly. "I'm awfully sorry. I shan't touch your files again, Miss Crane." "Oh, go on and call me Penny," she conceded impatiently. "What do you want now? and you can get anything you need out of the files if you'll just put the folder in the bottom drawer of my desk so that I can file it myself. Correctly.
Thank you, Penny, Bonnie Dundee said gravely. I'd like awfully to have the complete transcript of The State versus Maginty.
Mr. Sanderson is determined to get a conviction where our former district attorney most ingloriously failed. The new trial comes up in 2 weeks, and he wants me to try to uncover a missing link of evidence.
I know, she nodded, and stretched her short, slender body to pull down the 2 heavy volumes he required.
Without a by your leave, Special Investigator Dundee resumed his comfortable seat and laid the first of the volumes open upon his knees. But he did not seem to take a great deal of interest in the empanelling of jurors in the case of one Rufus Maginty, who had won the temporary triumph of a hung jury under the handling of the state's case by District Attorney Sherwood, deposed in November's election. Rather, his eyes followed the small brisk figure of Miss Penelope Crane as it moved about the room, and his ears listened to the somewhat charming, the emphatic tapping of her French heels. French heels! Hadn't she been wearing sensible Cuban-heeled Oxfords all other days of his first week, of his attachment to the district attorney's office? Cunning little thing! For all her thorniness and her sharpness with him, which he now saw that he had deserved. Pretty, too! Damned pretty! What colour was that dress of hers? Let's see. Chartreuse, didn't they call it? Chartreuse with big brown dots in it. Bet it was sleeveless under that short little jacket of golden-brown chiffon velvet. By Jove! And Dundee lapsed into one of the Englishisms he had picked up during his 6 months' work in England as a tyro in the records department of Scotland Yard before he had come to Hamilton to make a humble beginning as a cub detective on the homicide squad. Yes, by Jove, she was all dressed up, for some reason or other.
Of course, because it's Saturday and you have the afternoon off.
Dundee finished his reverie aloud, to the astonishment of the small person trying to reach a file drawer just a little too high for her. I mean, he hastened to explain, that I've just noticed how beautiful your costume is, and found a reason for it. There was sudden colour in the creamy face. The French heels tapped an angry progress across the big office, and Penny sat down abruptly in her swivel chair, reached across the immaculate desk, snatched up a morning paper and tossed it, without a glance, in the general direction of her tormentor.
"Page 3, column 2, first item," she informed him ungraciously, and then began to search, with a funny sort of desperation, for more work to consume her extraordinary energy.
Bonnie Dundee grinned indulgently as he opened the Hamilton Morning News and turned to the specified page and column.
"Ah, my old friend the society editress, in her very best style," he commented as he began to read aloud. "Mrs. Juanita Selim, new and charming member, is entertaining the Forsyte Alumni Bridge Club this afternoon, luncheon to be served at the exclusive new Breakaway Inn on Sheridan Road."
"I've read it, and I'm busy, so shut up," Penny commanded, as she gathered up pencils to sharpen.
Quite meekly, Bonnie Dundee subsided into silent perusal of an item he was sure could have no possible interest for himself, in either a personal or professional capacity, unless Penny's name was in it somewhere. After which the jolly party of young matrons and maids will adjourn to Mrs. Selim's delightful home in the Primrose Meadows edition. He chuckled and dared to interrupt the high importance of pointing up pencils.
"I say, that's funny, isn't it? Primrose Meadows edition."
"I don't think it's funny," Penny retorted coldly. "It so happens that my mother named it, that my father went into bankruptcy trying to make a go of it, and that Mrs. Selim's delightful home was built to be our home, and in which we were fortunate enough to live only 2 months before the crash came."
"Oh," Dundee groaned. "Penny, Penny, I'm dreadfully sorry."
"Shut up," she ordered, but her voice was huskier than ever with tears.
Dundee's now thoroughly interested eyes raced down the absurdly written paragraphs.
although not an alumna of that famous and select school for girls, Forsyte on the Hudson, graduation from which places any Hamilton girl in the very inner circle of Hamilton society, Mrs. Selim has been closely identified with the school, having for the past 2 years directed and staged Forsyte's annual play, which ushers in the Easter vacation. Indeed, it was Mrs. Selim's remarkable success with this year's play which caused Mrs. Peter Dunlap, long interested in a little theatre for Hamilton, to induce the beautiful and charming young directress to come to Hamilton with her. Plans for the little theatre are growing apace, and it is safe to conjecture that not all the conversation flying thick and fast about Nita's bridge tables this afternoon will be concerned with contract conventions, scores and finesses which failed. Lovely Nita was elected to membership a fortnight ago, when a vacancy occurred due to the resignation of Miss Alice Humphrey, who has gone abroad for a year's study in the Sorbonne. The two-table club now includes Mesdames Hugo Marshall, Tracy A. Miles, Peter Dunlap, John C. Drake, Juanita Selim, and Mrs. Polly Beale, Janet Raymond, and Penelope Crane. Dundee lowered the paper and stared at the profile of District Attorney Sanderson's private secretary. So she was a society girl, a Forsyte girl. Was that the reason, perhaps, why she had been so thorny with him, a mere dick? Well, he wasn't just a dick any longer. He was a special investigator, a society girl playing at work. But there was more, and he read on. As is well known, the girls have their hen fight bridge luncheon every Saturday afternoon from the 1st of October to the 1st of June, and a bridge dinner, in which mere men are graciously included, every other Wednesday evening during the season. Mr. and Mrs. Tracy A. Miles are scheduled as next Wednesday's host and hostess. "I'll take off my hat to your society editress," Dundee commented with false cheerfulness, when he had laid the paper back upon Penny's desk. "She makes half a column of this one item in what must be a meagre Saturday bunch of society notes, then writes it all over again in the past tense for an equally meagre Monday column. Like bridge, Miss Crane?" Penny snatched up the paper and crushed it into her wastebasket. "I do, and I like my old friends, even if I am not able financially to keep up with them. If that's why you've suddenly decided to stop being comrades." "Please forgive me again, Penny," he begged gently. "I was born into that crowd, and I still belong to it, because all of them are my real friends. But get this into your thick Scotch-Irish head, Mr. Dundee. I'm working because I have to, and because I love it, too, and because I want to earn enough before I'm many years older to give Mother some of the things she's missing so dreadfully since my father failed and ran away." "Run away?" Dundee echoed incredulously. "How could any man desert a daughter like this?" "Yes, ran away," she repeated fiercely. "I might as well tell you myself. Plenty of others will be willing to, as soon as they know you are my friend. As I told you, my father—" Her voice broke. "My father went bankrupt, but before the courts knew it, he had sent some securities to a woman in New York, and when he left us, he went to her, because he left Mother a note saying so. His defrauded creditors have tried to catch him, but they haven't yet." Very gently Bonnie Dundee took the small hand that was distractedly rumpling the brown waves which swept back from the widow's peak. It lay fluttering in his bigger palm for a moment, then snatched itself away. "I won't have you feeling sorry for me," she cried angrily. "Who owns the Primrose Meadows house now? Mrs. Selim?" he asked. "The lovely Nita?" Her voice was scornful. "No, she rents it from Judge Hugo Marshall, or is supposed to pay him rent," she added with a trace of malice. "Hugo is an old darling, but he is fearfully weak where pretty women are concerned. Nita Selim had known Hugo in New York, somehow, and as soon as Lois, Mrs. Dunlap, I mean, had got Nita off the train, the stranger in our midst hied herself to Hugo's office, and he's been tagging after her ever since, though most of the men in our crowd are as bad as or worse than poor old Hugo. How Karen keeps on looking so blissfully happy.
Karen? Dundee interrupted.
Mrs. Hugo Marshall, she explained impatiently. Karen Plummer made her debut a year ago, this last winter, a darling of a girl. Judge Marshall, retired judge, you know, had been proposing to the prettiest girl in each season's crop of debs for the last 20 years, and Hugo must have been the most nonplussed perennial bachelor who ever led a grand march when Karen snapped him up. Loved him, actually. And it seems to have worked out marvellously. A baby boy, 3 months old, she concluded in her laconic style. Then, ashamed, I don't know why I'm gossiping like this.
Because you can't find another blessed scrap of work to do, you little efficiency fiend.
Dundee laughed. Come on, gossip some more. My Maginty case will wait till afternoon, to be mulled over while you're losing your hard-earned salary at bridge with rich women.
We don't play for high stakes, she corrected him. Just a 20th of a cent a point, though contract can run into money even at that. The winnings all go to the Foresight Scholarship Fund. On Wednesday evenings, the crowd plays for higher stakes, a tenth, and winners keepers. Therefore, I can't afford to go, unless I sink so low as to let my escort pay my losses, which I sometimes do, she confessed, her brown head low for a moment.
Is this Mrs. Peter Dunlap, a deep-bosomed clubwoman who starts movements? He asked, more to bring her out of her depression than anything else. Bigger and better babies movements, and homes for fallen girls, and little theatre movements?
The brown head flung itself up sharply, and the brown eyes hardened into bright pennies again.
Lois Dunlap is the sweetest, finest, most comfortable woman in Hamilton, and I adore her. As does everyone else, Peter Dunlap hardly more than the rest of us. She is interested in a little theatre for Hamilton, but she won't manage it. That's why she got hold of Nita Selim. Lois will simply put up barrels of money, without missing them, and give a grand job to a little Broadway gold digger.
Funny thing is, she really delights in Nita, thinks she's sweet, and has never had a real chance.
And what do you think? Dundee asked softly.
Oh, I suppose I'm a cat, but I can see through her so clearly. Not that she's bad, she's simply an opportunist. She's awfully sweet and deferential and frank with women, but with men, well, she simply tucks her head so that her shoulder-length black curls fall forward enchantingly, gives them one wistful smile out of her big eyes that are like black pansies, and the clink of slave chains. Now go on and think I'm catty, which I suppose I am.
Bonnie Dundee grinned at her reassuringly. Not for him to explain that practically all women and many men found themselves gossiping when he led them on adroitly, for reasons of his own, which of course helped him to make the excellent detective he was.
So all the men in your crowd have fallen for Nita Selim, have they?
Practically all, in varying degrees, except Peter Dunlap, who has never looked at another woman since he was lucky enough to get Lois, and Clive Hammond, who's engaged to Polly Beale, Penny answered reluctantly, her colour high.
Including your young man?
I haven't a young man in the sense of being engaged, Penny retorted, then added honestly, I have been letting Ralph Hammond, that's Clive's brother, you know, take me about a good deal. Ralph and Clive have plenty of money, she defended herself hastily. They are architects, Clive being the head of the firm, and Ralph, who hasn't been out of college so very long, a junior partner. It was the Hammond firm that drew up the plans for Dad's, I mean my father's, Primrose Meadows addition houses. He had our house built as a sort of show place, you know, so that prospective builders out there could see how artistic a home could be put up for a moderate sum of money. But he didn't quite finish even that. left half the gabled top story unfinished, and Nita has been teasing Hugo to finish it up for her. It looks," she added with a shrug, "as if Nita will get what she wants, as usual."
"And Ralph has acquired a set of slave chains?" Dundee suggested, with just the slightest note of sympathy.
"And how?" Penny assured him grimly. "A simile as out of date as my clothes are going to be if I don't get some new ones soon. Not that the crowd minds what I wear," she added loyally. "I could dress up in a window drape, and be just as charming as you are in that grand new party dress you have on now," Dundee finished for her gallantly.
"New!" Penny snorted and turned back to her desk in a futile effort to find something left undone.
Dundee ignored the rebuff. How many gentlemen with moderate incomes actually built in Primrose Meadows?
"You are inquisitive, aren't you?"
"None. Our house, or rather the one Nita Selim is living in now, is the only house on what used to be a big farm.
Why?"
"I was just wondering," Dundee said softly, almost absent-mindedly, "why the lovely Nita chose so isolated a place in which to live, when Hamilton has rather a large number of for rent signs out just now. By the way, know what time it is now? 20 to 1. Get your hat on, young woman. I'm going to drive you out to Breakaway Inn."
"You're not. I'm going to take a bus. One runs from the square right past the inn," she told him firmly.
And just as firmly Dundee escorted her out of the almost deserted, rather dirty old courthouse to where his brand-new sports roadster, bought on time, was awaiting them in the parking space devoted to the motors of those who officially served Hamilton County.
"I know why you want to drive me out to the inn," Penny told him suddenly, as the proud owner manoeuvred his car through Saturday noon traffic. "You want to see Nita Selim. Clank, clank. I can hear the padlocks snapping in the slave chains right now."
"Meow," Dundee retorted, then grinned down at her with as much comradely affection as if they had been friends for years instead of for a couple of hours.
"Is Nita very small?" he added.
"Little enough to tuck herself under the arm of a man a lot shorter than you," Penny assured him with curious vehemence. "And if Penelope Crane is no mean prophet, that's exactly what she'll do within 5 minutes after she meets you, just as she is wistfully inviting you to join the other men for the cocktail party which is scheduled to break up the bridge game at 5:30. Then, of course, you'll be urged to join us all at the dinner dance at the country club tonight."
"Will she?"
Dundee pretended to be vastly intrigued, which caused the remainder of the drive to be a rather silent one, due to Penny's unresponsiveness. Breakaway Inn was intensely Spanish in architecture and transplanted shrubbery, but its stucco walls were of a rather more violent raspberry colour than is considered quite aesthetic in Spain or Mexico.
"There's Lois Dunlap's car just driving up," Penny cried, her face softening with the adoration she had freely professed for her friend.
But it clouded again almost instantly. "And Nita Selim. I suppose Nita was a little ashamed to drive up in her own Ford coupe."
As Dundee helped his new friend to alight, his eyes were upon the two women being assisted by a uniformed chauffeur from Lois Dunlap's limousine. In a moment the four were a laughing, exclamatory group.
"Oh, what a tall, grand man you've got yourself, Penny darling!" the tiny, beautiful creature who could only be Mrs. Selim cried out happily. "May I meet him?"
"I shouldn't let you," Penny answered frankly, "but I will. Mrs. Selim, Mr. Dundee, and Mrs. Dunlap, Mr. Dundee. How are you, Lois? And Peter and the brats?"
"All well, Penny. Peter is off on a weekend fishing trip, and not one of the brats has measles, scarlet fever, or hay fever, thank God,"
Dundee heard Mrs. Dunlap say in the comfortable, affectionate voice that went with her comfortable, pleasant face and body. "Nice woman." But his eyes were of necessity upon Nita Selim, for that miniature Venus was, as Penny had predicted, almost tucked under his arm by this time, her black pansy eyes wide and wistful,
her soft black curls falling forward as she coaxed. "You'll come to the cocktail party at my house at 5:30, won't you, Mr. Dundee?"
"Afraid I can't make it," Dundee smiled down at her.
"I'm a busy man, Mrs. Selim. You see, I'm special investigator attached to the district attorney's office," he explained very deliberately.
"Oh, Nita Selim breathed. Then, step by step, she withdrew, so that he was no longer submitted to the temptation to put his arm about her too intriguing little body. And as she retreated, Dundee's keen eyes noted a hardening of the black pansy eyes, the sudden throbbing of a pulse in her very white neck.
"No, don't mind about calling for me," Penny protested a moment later. "Ralph has already volunteered. Thanks awfully."
As Dundee backed out of the driveway, his last glance was for a very small figure in a brown silk summer coat and palest yellow chiffon frock. Slowly rejoining Penelope Crane and Lois Dunlap, what the devil had frightened her so? For she had been almost terrified. Of course she might be one of those silly women who shudder at the sight of a detective because they've smuggled in a diamond from Paris or a bottle of Bacardi from Havana. But long before his car made the distance back to the city, Dundee had shrugged off the riddle and was concentrating on all the facts he knew regarding the Maginty case. It was his first real assignment from Sanderson, and he was determined to make good. 4 hours later he was interrupted in his careful reading of the trial of Rufus Maginty by the ringing of the telephone bell. That made 4 times he had to snap out the fact that District Attorney Sanderson was playing some well-earned golf on the country club links, Dundee reflected angrily as he picked up the receiver. But the call was for Dundee himself, and the voice on the other end of the wire was Penny Crane's, although almost unrecognizable. "Speak more slowly, Penny," Dundee urged. "What's that again?"
"Good Lord, you say that Nita Selim..."
After a minute of listening and a promise of instant obedience, Dundee hung up the receiver.
"My God," he said slowly, blankly, "of all things, murder at bridge."
End of chapter 1. Recorded by Gesine in September 2007.